This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Anthony Fennell. Welcome to The Roundtable. Here's an unsettling fact for a Sunday morning. Australia has the highest gambling population in the world. I'll let that sink in. The highest in the world. We even outdo the United States, which of course is home to that mecca of casino culture, Las Vegas. 80% of Australians will gamble at some point in any given year to the collective tune of $26 billion. And there's no shortage of gambling options and venues ready to swallow up the wallets and purses of those who can afford it and impoverish those who can't. Today on The Roundtable, we'll look through the back window of the casinos, gaming venues and online platforms. And we're fortunate to welcome three guests with expertise and lived experience in the game. Charles Livingston is an Associate Professor in the School of Public Health and Preventative Medicine at Monash University in Melbourne. Louise Francis is a gambling researcher also at Monash. And Kate Seselja is the founder of The Hope Project, an organisation for those who find themselves caught in the downward spiral of gambling addiction. Welcome to you all. Welcome to the roundtable.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Thank you.
Let's start with the murky world of casinos, or more specifically, let's look at what's happened when one of those casinos got caught out for criminal behaviour. Last week, this happened.
Melbourne's Crown Casino has been fined $80 million over a scheme that allowed the illegal transfer of funds from China.
Charles Livingston, if I can start with you, this is the first time that an $80 million fine has been handed down for casino crime. Could I get you to explain to us what exactly happened?
So in this case, what was happening was the Crown was facilitating deposits being made from a particular credit card company, the China UnionPay credit system. Now, that forbids people from using their funds for gambling, but more importantly, credit cards are not supposed to be used to purchase gambling credits in Victoria or indeed throughout Australia. So what that means is that they were breaching the law on at least two fronts and probably committing fraud. They got fined $80 million because the Victorian government recently increased the maximum fine that they could be fined from $1 million to $100 million after the Finkelstein Royal Commission and the new regulator decided that it was worthy of prosecution. I might add that Star City in Sydney has fessed up to doing exactly the same thing with up to $900 million worth of credits or chips being bought using China UnionPay credit cards. So I expect they should be in line for a similar penalty if that's possible.
Now, $80 million, I mean, that's an awful lot of money, but it's not a lot of money to the casinos, is it really?
Well, it's small change, really. I guess it's like an average person being fined a couple of grand for a speeding offence. It's enough to hurt a little bit, but it's not going to necessarily have a long-term effect. And I think the problem is, until this point, in fact, the regulatory system and indeed the penalties and their capacity to be enforced has been pretty modest, to put it generously. And in many cases, the regulators have either been cowed by the casinos or, in the case of WA, literally in bed with them, as it were.
Does the bad PR that comes from a situation like this, does it matter to these large gambling operations, or do they just factor this in as part of, you know, just what happens?
Well, I mean, I think it probably hurts a little bit. I mean, certainly it has caused enormous reputational damage. But having said that, I mean, they've still got people wanting to buy the business and to make it, you know, profitable once again and to pursue this, this sort of madness of trying to entice people to spend all their money and do so now, I guess, without at least in the short term the lure of all the money laundering and exploitation of gamblers that they've done in the past, because presumably the regulators will be keeping an eye on that now. But The problem is, of course, over time, we forget about the lessons we've learnt and we end up with a regulatory system which is, again, not fit for purpose. So the big challenge coming out of this is to make sure that the regulatory system does do what it's supposed to do and stop them from the gross exploitation of people, which has been their stock in trade, and, of course, the money laundering and infiltration from criminal sources, which has been, I guess, the more newsworthy aspect of this, but nonetheless still a significant one.
And early last year, as I understand, Crown was told that they weren't allowed to open a second casino in New South Wales after an independent Liquor and Gaming Authority inquiry. Yeah. And that inquiry found that there were regulation breaches, they were found unfit to hold a gaming licence, but the casino was already built, wasn't it, the second one?
Yeah, the Barangaroo Casino was built for reasons which are still obscure, right on the foreshore of Sydney Harbour in a piece of prime real estate which was originally destined for a public park. It was, you know, the approval for that appears to have been given after Alan Jones hosted a lunch with the then Premier of New South Wales and Mr Packer, at which this proposal was discussed, and shortly after that it was green-lighted, so to speak, without it even being called for. So there was no public tender called or anything, and indeed up until that point the official policy in New South Wales was that there would be but one casino, the Star Casino. So, you know, this is an example of how much political influence the casino business, particularly Crown, has generated, and it suggests that, you know, the rules until this point at any rate have not applied to them. Now, whether that continues to be the case, I guess we'll find out in due course, but up until this point the casinos have literally gotten away with anything that they want to get away with, and that's the problem. I think they just got used to it, and when the axe finally fell, they were all at sea. They didn't know quite what to do, and they've been struggling to catch up ever since, I think.
Look, just to be clear, so will Crown end up with two casinos?
It looks like that. I mean, I heard a news report on the ABC, in fact, yesterday, which suggested that they were getting close to getting their second casino licence for Barangaroo under condition.
I think the State Cabinet's meeting to talk about it tomorrow.
Yes.
We'll be talking about it tomorrow.
Yes, that's right. So I think the indications are that they'll probably get it. It's supposed to be a high roller casino, which means, you know, no poker machines and so on, but that's very unlikely to continue given that there aren't any high rollers around at the moment, certainly none from China. So there may be a few in New South Wales, but not enough to sustain the business model that was originally proposed for that casino. So my guess is that it will be a pokey joint as soon as possible.
Louise Francis, you're now based in Perth. A report that came from the West Australian Royal Commission into Gambling late last year highlighted unhealthy familiarity between casino staff and the bureaucrats that were meant to regulate them, meant to regulate gambling activity. Could I get you to talk to us about that? How close had some of those relationships become?
So my understanding with that relationship with the regulator and executives within the casino were, I guess, on familiar terms, fishing trips. Again, through a news report, I understand that there may have been a purchase of one of the boats, whether it was the regulator's boat or the executive's boat. So they were on quite familiar terms. And rather than doing the regulating and oversight and auditing, it was more of a familiar friendship-based relationship.
Was a lack of experience among senior regulators, was that an issue here, do we know?
I'm not sure of whether it's a lack of experience, other than the fact that I guess from the executives in Crown knowing how potentially to work the system, and so that becomes a problem when it's not at arm's length and the auditors aren't actually doing their job.
So that unhealthy familiarity was identified, as I said, by the WA Royal Commission into Gambling. Is there any suggestion that those kinds of relationships exist in other states and jurisdictions?
I'm not familiar with that. Charles might be better placed around the Victorian scene, whether that is the situation.
Charles, your thoughts?
Yeah, so in WA the situation was, I think they were fairly inexperienced in gambling regulation. Certainly there was no one with vast experience in regulating gambling that was working on the regulatory side in WA, and they were, as Louise just said, very familiar with each other. In Victoria, the situation was different. I think the regulator was cowed by the influence of the casino, and the Royal Commission in Victoria found that it was not uncommon for senior staff of the casino to get in touch with ministers and all ministerial staff to get them to lay off the casino. So the regulator was perhaps trying to do their job, but was repeatedly advised that it wasn't in the interests of the state for them to do so. And beyond that, there was also essentially a bipartisan deal between the political parties in Victoria that said, you know, the casino's too big to fail, so just go easy on them. And I think that message was pretty well absorbed by the regulators, who in any event were understaffed, under-resourced and certainly underpowered in terms of what they could and couldn't get after from the casino.
Kate Seselja from Hope Project. Casinos and gaming venues sell themselves as contributors to the community. In Brisbane, I know there's a massive casino, ironically being built right next to the government administration building and right next to the parliament. And, you know, it's being sold by the government, by the casino operators and by the local government as a new, you know, entertainment precinct for the city. These casinos, they donate to local clubs for community projects. They provide venues like this new precinct, you know, filled with restaurants and family-friendly activities. But, you know, the sort of people that come in to you, to your organisation and need help, how do they feel about that? I mean, do they feel like these operators are being family-friendly?
No, it's one of those myths that, you know, has been very cleverly executed. People have this unrealistic understanding of what their role is in the community, and that is not to actually deliver, you know, good things, but to actually take from the community and just create this illusion of, you know, social well-being. But they're actually an imposed toxin, like an introduced cancer to our social spaces, rather than, you know, in the Canberra environment, they take $167 million out of the local community and return $11 million. So they get to glorify this, you know, $11 million that they hand out in novelty checks.
And as I mentioned, governments at various levels go along with this, don't they? I know, again, talking about the new Brisbane casino, the government has spent a lot of money promoting this new project.
Yeah, it's that's how it's sold, and that's how it's justified in their minds that, you know, they're doing good. But when you add up the social cost of them being there, it doesn't make any financial sense or well-being sense.
Tell us about the sort of people who end up coming to you at Hope Project. In what state are they by the time they get to you?
Unfortunately, when people do reach for help, they're at crisis point because they've tried everything within their own power to try and understand and, you know, change what's been happening. But because of this, you know, the narratives around gambling's just fun, it's just entertainment, you know, the person's left with what's wrong with me, and helping them to understand the whole gambling landscape in this country is the first step of liberating that person out of personal shame.
One thing that that I find curious is that a lot of the sports, you know, sports app gambling that you see advertised on television, it plays on humour. And it also plays on a sense of Australian mateship. Mm. How seductive is that for people?
Oh, it's extremely seductive and alluring. You know, it's an intentional predatory industry. So even if people do want to try and get out of whatever, you know, app they've downloaded, then they're targeted even more heavily by marketing or phone calls, you know, to try and convince them to stay with the company that they're gambling with.
Charles, you mentioned high rollers before, but a lot of people, is it right to say the bread and butter of the gambling industry are people who are referred to by casino insiders as the grind? You know, and they're not high rollers.
No, they're not high rollers. Most of the money in Australian casinos comes from poker machines. For example, the high point of that is in the Rest Point and the Launceston casinos in Tassie. 92% of their revenue comes from the poker machines. And they're certainly not high rollers. I mean, there are certainly machines there where people can bet unrestricted and so on, and they spend a lot of money, but it's not the glamorous James Bond-style blackjack table that we're talking about here. It's people just putting all their money into poker machines, which are, of course, very addictive, and in Australia, of course, ubiquitous. So, yes, I mean...
Sorry, just jump in there. They're designed to be addictive as well, aren't they? I mean, they have, you know, these companies not only have very clever technicians working on the equipment, they also employ psychologists in the United States.
Well, yes, they certainly do. But, I mean, the reality is that even if it's just a hit-and-miss business, they can deploy their machines into the world's biggest laboratory, i.e. Every gambling venue in the world, and see which ones work and which ones don't. And they're constantly putting new machines out there with slight tweaks and variations to see which one will work. And because they have perfect data from these machines, as indeed do the authorities, they know which ones are the most profitable, which ones work in what venue. And so when you walk into a gambling venue, you'll see a whole variety of different machines, each one catering to a specific sub-market within the venue. And, you know, they're not there by accident. They're there because they've been carefully designed and integrated into a sort of an economy of taste, if you like, by the people that use them. So there's machines which appeal to, you know, elderly ladies, there's machines which appeal to young men and all the rest of it. So, you know, by and large in Australia, more than half of the amount of money we lose every year, about $26 billion, is spent on poker machines, either in venues or in casinos. And, you know, of that, $7 billion or so is spent in New South Wales alone. So we're looking at an extraordinarily large industry based on an addictive product, which... in my opinion, most of the regulators don't fully understand and certainly don't know how to regulate effectively.
So just quickly, just running through how the gambling industry really looks. So poker machines are the big draw, are they? They're the big money earner, followed by what?
Yeah, about $15 billion. So then we've got probably wagering at the moment, including sports betting, which is probably worth around $5 billion. The rest of casinos is probably worth a couple of billion. That is the actual high rolls and the table games and so on. We've got Lotto, which is worth a couple of billion. And then down the list, we've got Keno and so on and so forth. So essentially, the big earners in Australian gambling are number one, poker machines, and then air, and then wagering, with about $1.5 billion of wagering being spent on sports betting.
Louise Francis, what sort of taxes do gambling operations pay?
The variety. So my focus has been on the community clubs, and they don't have to pay any corporate taxes. They do actually pay their gambling tax, which is not a high rate. I think it right now in game. Charles, please correct me if I'm wrong. It's between each state between about 9% they get out of gambling from taxes. But the clubs which I focus on don't need to pay any tax, and they get a subsidised rate on that. Oh, well, they pay tax, but they get a subsidised rate if they give back to the community. So
what's the rationale for them not paying that tax?
That tax, the rationale is that they're giving back into the community. So I've investigated particularly the scheme in Victoria, which shows that if they contribute 8.33% of their earnings and their gambling earnings, and it's given back to the community, then that reduces their tax rate. But what we actually see, and it's it is covered by the legislation, it's all above board, but they can actually claim their operating expenses as an indirect community benefit. And so the research Charles and I have looked at shows that up to 75% or more is claimed as an operating expense, but that's considered a community contribution indirectly. And what they're actually giving back to community is less than 2.2%, about 2.5%. Going back to what Kate talked about is that the novelty checks going out, the community is welcoming of that money and it's needed at the grassroots sports and community level, but it's not a huge amount when we look at the bigger picture.
Now, Louise, Western Australia, as I mentioned earlier, we mentioned Western Australia earlier, sorry, but it's unique, isn't it, in that it banned poker machines in 1985, I think was the year, except the ones in the casino. 37 years later, do most people in the state still support that ban, and do they think it's a good idea?
Absolutely. There's no expectation on in the WA community for us to introduce pokies, and it's certainly been a strong a view, I think, across the board and across both sides of government. So both Liberal and Labor governments have indicated that they will not and they will continually oppose introduction of pokies and similar gaming machines in WA. But we have recently had the issue with the proposed sale of the TAB. So Tabcorp is a current front runner for that. It was put on hold due to COVID. But part of that sale, there was going to be the introduction of simulated racing machines. Now, these are not pokies, but they are a machine and operated by a computer. There's no skill base to it. So that was very much an important part of the TAB sale, and it's not known at this point whether it's still included as part of the possible sale that is potentially going to go to Tabcorp that was reintroduced in October last year, and the tender was closed in November last year, and we're not sure where that's at with the government at the moment. But
so if those machines go ahead and are introduced, I mean, they're not poker machines, but, you know, to the average person in the street, they wouldn't sound like they're much different to a poker machine. How much of a difference will they make to the community? Does it mean that Western Australia will be very much like the rest of the country?
It's a starting point, and I think that's what the concern is. So they are not a poker machine, but they are very much have the possibility to grow. So like when pokies were introduced, you know, 30 years ago in Victoria, those machines are quite different to what they are today. So the technological advancements, and I think, you know, we talk about the legislation not keeping up with those technological advancements, and the problem becomes that if we introduce them into WA, how do they transform over time? And if they don't set up really strong legislation from the beginning, we will see a significant change, and we might become, you know, where Victoria and the eastern states and New South Wales are now with the pokies. And I think they've been sold to the government and how the industry has introduced simulated racing and what it means, they haven't really been above board with how it's been described to them and what it might mean in the future.
And our guests on the roundtable today are Louise Francis, Charles Livingston, and also Kate Seselja. Kate, personal experience. Before you started Hope Project, you had your own issues with poker machines, didn't you? And I bring this up only to, you know, for those of us who don't gamble, the whole idea of being seduced and addicted to these kind of machines doesn't kind of make any sense. But, I mean, tell us about your experience.
Well, it was something that I never even expected to happen. You know, I was taught about smoking and drinking in school, but never about gambling harm. And so when I started playing, that rush of winning, you know, initially was something very unique to my brain. But at that time, I thought I was alone in that struggle. And a decade and a half later, after almost taking my life, I realised I wasn't the only one to have ever struggled with using these machines. And it's what led me to start the Hope Project, to try and be that voice where there wasn't one.
And the machines themselves, as we said before, they're designed to be addictive. Mm. But what sort of incentives are offered by casinos and gaming venues? What sort of incentives are offered to patrons to keep them playing?
Free drinks, some venues free food, in the case of the deceased gentleman in New South Wales. They were running across the road getting his cigarettes for him. There isn't anything that a venue won't do to try and keep you there. If they know that you're, you know, going to happily hand over all of your money.
Louise, you've just submitted a research paper that challenges the control that the pokies have in RSL clubs. How was that received?
I have submitted the paper and it's still being finalised, but it's an interesting concept. As I said, Charles and I have looked at these community contributions and we did focus on previously on sports clubs, the golf clubs, and I did want to look at the RSLs because I thought they are pokey venues within RSLs, and did their pattern of community giving match what the other clubs, which was not really high? And it turns out the RSL clubs, they do amazing things, and we know that the RSL is a revered institution. But the ones with pokies are not fully accountable to the veteran community, and I think it's concerning the level of support they could be providing could be far greater based on the documents and the community benefit documents that we've reviewed. It shows that they're still using operating expenses as the main source of community giving to get their discount on their reduced tax rate. So it's as high as 72% of operating costs and as low as 2.6% is actually going back directly to the community, and not that all of that is going to the veteran community.
And all of this, all that we've talked about today, all of this is you know, given the approval of various political parties and various governments, isn't it? I mean, a recent ABC investigation found that the gambling industry was one of the biggest political donors in the country, and that the major parties got the lion's share of that, $18 million in recent years to state and territory parties. Mostly, it has to be said, in that case, to Labor parties, Labor governments, and more than $50 million over the past decade to the parties at a federal level. What does that kind of largesse from gambling operations, what does that do to our democracy, to the way our government, treats us and our relationship with government?
I think that from the donations perspective, it is concerning because it's saying that we can literally pay off governments if we've got their influence and that money and the argument could be on the reverse that it doesn't mean anything. If it didn't mean anything, you wouldn't be paying it out and you'd be using that money for other purposes. So they are large sums of money. It's not a transparent system. We don't see those donations immediately, and it's and correct me if I'm wrong, I think it's 12 months before they come through. Is that right, Charles? So we don't see it immediately. So it's really hard to track that in real time.
Well, look, we'll have to leave it there, unfortunately. Many thanks, Charles, Louise and Kate. Charles is an associate professor, Charles Livingston, an associate professor in the School of Public Health at Monash University. Louise Francis is a gambling researcher also at Monash. And Kate Seselja is the founder of the Hope Project. I'm Anthony Fennell. Cheers and thanks for joining me.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.